ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jade Portman, and today our special guest is Ben Gremillion, who is a professional writer and content designer at UXPin, and today our topic is writing about UI UX design. Hi, Ben.
Hello. How are you doing?
Thanks for joining us today. Thank you. Doing great.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, as you know, we're starting off with a quick quiz style questionnaire so that we can learn about yourself as much as possible before diving into the main topic. How does that sound?
That sounds great.
Amazing. So, question one is, what do you do for a living these days?
Well, I produce content in general. It's mostly educational about my employer's product. That's UXPin, like you said. My work includes making webinars, writing blog posts and tutorials, and I also host a weekly Twitter chat. I'm also working on a certification program and a comprehensive user manual.
Well, that's a ton. How do you manage all that? Yes. So you also get to develop strategy for all that?
Strategy is not really my strong point there. For the most part, I do a lot of planning, trying to figure out what people need to know and the best way to get that material to them in a way that's easy to digest.
Mm-hmm. We'll definitely talk about that later on. So how did you get to this place where you are today?
Oh, it's been a very strange road to get here. In college, I started learning about video and animation, but somehow I wound up in newspaper design and illustration. Picked up HTML, CSS, PHP, and a few others when I saw the way newspapers were going, and worked at a few startups and a couple of large corporations building websites and web apps. Now, on the side, I did some writing for Smashing Magazine, Team Treehouse, Web Designer Depot, a few others. So a few years ago, I decided to try writing full-time. I think that was about 2012. Now, freelancing didn't really pan out, so I got a job at Zurb, conducting webinars and writing blog posts. And now I'm on the content production team at UXPin.
Wow, that's an amazing lineup of companies. You have a good writing portfolio, actually amazing, Smashing Magazine, and you worked for Zurb. That's like super awesome.
Yeah, it was quite an experience.
Mm-hmm. Right, next question. What does your typical day look like?
Well, a typical day for me isn't really typical for my teammates. I'm in the office around 8 a.m. and it's nice and quiet until about 10. See, most of my team prefers to work from home in the mornings because some are up as early as 5 a.m. to have meetings with our Poland office.
Whoa.
I spend
that
about...
resonates with me. Sure. Sorry.
That's fine. I spend like half an hour getting towards inbox zero or at least single digits. And try to get as much actual work done as I can by like 11. Towards lunchtime, I do customer support for a side project, the Grolic CMS, unless there's an emergency or something. And my afternoons are all over the place. They're pockmarked with meetings and various bits of work.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about Grolic.
Well, the Grolic CMS is a tool that my wife and I developed to help artists publish comics on the web. We're looking for a 2.0 beta test next month, in fact.
Mm-hmm. I know what Grolic means because I encountered the term occasionally, accidentally, actually, last week. But tell our users what Grolic is.
Well, the theme we went with, well, let me back up. We started the project when we realized there wasn't a really good CMS for artists trying to get their web comics put together. A lot of them use WordPress or Tumblr or something, but there's nothing really dedicated to it. The few projects we found had either been abandoned or weren't really maintained as well as we thought they could be. So we said we want artists to help to stop swearing at their CMS. They wanted to spend more time drawing than debugging. So we used the word Grolic, which means using those symbols and words of profanity. We found an artist to help us, came up with the purple bat, our mascot, Bleep. And we put together a CMS.
That sounds amazing. That's power of getting niche down to a certain audience.
Yeah, we didn't know how well it would be received at first, but we seem to have picked up a pretty good audience.
That sounds amazing. So, going back to the writing part, what do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
The most, I enjoy working with people to learn about design, and I learn a lot from them as well. It's good to get into the like one-on-one conversations, Twitter or Skype or whatever, and just talk shop, figure out what people like, figure out the different angles and how different people approach the problems.
So what do you usually do with that? Do you transcribe that and get it into posts, or is that all about webinars? What's your favorite format?
Oh, my favorite format. I'm not sure that I've got one, actually. It's the right tool for the job at hand. When I talk to people, I just kind of absorb as much as I can, save it for future use.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. What about what you like the least?
I'm not a big fan of having to redo old work. I like to move on from what I've done in the past. UXPen recently redesigned it, everything, really. The whole editor, the dashboard, we got a new engine. And when that happened, I had to revisit dozens of old tutorials and make new screenshots, animated GIFs, and videos. Had to get done, but it wasn't my favorite.
That totally resonates with everyone in the world, for sure. I think I just saw someone complaining on Twitter about Apple having iPhone, 1.0 in their guidelines.
Yeah.
So you're much more proactive when it comes to that. Well, kudos for completing that bunch of work.
Well, thank you. It was a lot of work.
So what's your next big thing?
Well, two things. Like I said earlier, we're looking to launch beta of version 2.0, Galaxy CMS, in August. Fingers crossed on that one. We hit a couple of snags this week, but adapt and overcome. We're doing certification for UXPen. That should come up in the next couple of weeks, actually.
Great. Is that certification for designers?
It's for anyone who wants to communicate their ideas in UX design. UXPen isn't necessarily for designers. We know a lot of people who are either getting into design or need to communicate to designers and developers their ideas. And, sometimes paper and pencil just doesn't cut it.
True, absolutely. So, yeah, I just hit the wrong term there. So that certification is for people to be qualified to use UXPen in their work, that is.
That's right. It'll demonstrate proficiency in the app.
That sounds amazing. Is that a huge bulk of work on your side already done?
Most of it's done. The exam will come in two parts. There will be a multiple choice about, I think we're up to 50 questions now. And the other part will be practical. We're going to give people a prototype and simply say, rebuild this as closely as you can.
Awesome. So there will be a number of people working with people, like checking on the assignments to give the final certificate away?
We've got two people, including myself, dedicated to the project.
Yeah. Is there going to be like a small rolling launch or a big one?
We think it's going to be small at first. We've talked to some of our enterprise clients who are very interested in it, and we're going to start with them. Sort of a proof of concept because we've never done this before. But then we'll roll it out to anyone who wants to have that on their resume.
Mm-hmm. Sounds awesome. So now that we cleared up on the quiz questions, I would love to dive into the main topic, which is writing about design. And usually it goes, first you learn about design and practice design, and then you think like, in order to advance in my career, I need to now start blogging and stuff like that. How did it work out for you?
I'd have to say that it started in Photoshop, actually. A long time ago, I had the opportunity to teach at a community college for a number of semesters, and I knew Photoshop fairly well. At least I thought I did until I started teaching. And that's when you discover that maybe you don't know something as well as you thought you did. I certainly learned a lot from having to answer really basic questions. How do you arrange things? Where do you get the tools? What if I want to do this? And that started me off on... Well, whenever I teach something, no one learns more than I do.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. but so what were your biggest surprises when you started teaching design things? Any discoveries about the learning process itself? What was the hardest?
The hardest thing at first was getting over myself. I thought that I was pretty hot stuff, but it turns out that no, I don't have all the answers. I had to kind of invent my way out of that. So these days when I write and produce things, I always make sure to keep in mind that you don't have all the answers. You never have all the answers. I've been doing this for, I've been teaching for 8 years. I've been doing content stuff for 4 years, I think, since about 2012. Mm-hmm. And I still learn something every day, every week. Everyone has a different philosophy. Everyone has a different approach. And there's no one way to attack it. You know, there's an old saying that if you ask 10 developers how to do something, you'll get 15 different answers.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So let's walk through the process of creating professional content. That definitely should start with a purpose. So is that marketing or education or everything altogether?
Well, there's a little bit of both. Everything I do these days does serve the company, and we need to have some kind of a tie-in to UXPen. Or if I'm doing the Grolux CMS, it's got to have a tie back to the app. But at the same time, the primary goal is to educate people, to give them something that they didn't know before, to show them a new angle, give them a new perspective. So I start off by you're right, coming up with a goal, coming up with a topic. Say color theory, for example, and different ways to use color for accessibility, for example. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of research after that, figure out what's been done before, what people have said about it, run a lot of Google searches, or in my case, DuckDuckGo, and figure out what can I add to the conversation? Excuse me. What can I do that hasn't been done before, or what do I bring to the table?
How does it feel? Because if you go like about color theory, for example, that's all been done 1,000 times, and you probably feel like at a loss if you're trying to come up with new approaches. So what do you do to freshen up in that direction?
Well, it is pretty tricky because you're right; everything has been done before. You do research on any obscure topic; the more obscure, the better. The more focused, the better. But you try to think of something that just hasn't been done. You look for a new twist on things. And you got to make sure that your audience has, well, you don't want to insult them. They've read about it before. Yours is probably one of a dozen articles or video casts or something that they've looked up on the topic, either that day or in the past. So you want to engage them, and you want to come up with something different. Like a while back, I wrote about not just colors in design, but how you can use hexadecimal colors, how to read them, how to write them, and how you can adjust the actual values in those six-digit combinations to your advantage. Turned out mm-hmm. to be one of my most popular articles ever.
Yeah, that sounds like I would love to read about that too. Awesome. I know there are a dozen techniques out there. Some of them I use as well about collecting, you know, painful topics that people want to learn about. So what I do, I look what people talk about in forums. I look into comments that people send to me in the emails describing their pains. Do you have any of your specific methods of collecting topics and exploring the audience?
I start with what I already know about it, or at least what I think I know about it. Draw on a lot of my experience from the past and what I'm doing right now. It's important to keep on doing, you know, practicing what you're writing about. After that, I simply do a lot of research. I'm not afraid to start with Wikipedia, but mm-hmm. I always, that's just a foundation that's going on from there. These days, I find myself scrolling immediately to the bottom and looking at all the references before I go any further.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, because Wikipedia can be edited by anyone. You got to take it with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. And usually it's stuff that's common sense and people already know about. There's not much informative in the articles themselves. It's like, what inspired the article? Where did it come from?
usually get links to like scientific research, something more substantial than Wikipedia itself, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Same thing goes for any other source, really. You look at the intro and the conclusion, and if it's a well-written article, you know what the article is about in a matter of moments. Mm-hmm. And from there, you try to figure out not just what's on the surface, not just what the words are, but where the article is coming from, where the author started, what they know, and what they're trying to say. There's a lot of subtext.
Huh. Yeah. So once you define the topic that you're going to be writing about, what are your next steps?
Well, you figure out the topic. You figure out your angle. I try to write those down. These days, I use Evernote to keep track of everything. There's another program called Ulysses. You may have heard of that. I use that for a lot of my composing. Mm-hmm. Great program, that one. I do a lot of research. I try to figure out exactly what's going on. And then I write down, I just kind of brainstorm everything that I know about the subject. If we're going into color, I'll revisit some of my old work, look up accessibility, and try to figure out what's going on. What is the article going to look like in a way? I try to visualize it, I guess. It's funny, I've never actually put this into words. I think there's a blog post in this. Interesting.
Definitely.
Let me jot this down.
Yeah, sure.
There we go. Okay.
Awesome. So do you have any specific structure that you like to follow with your posts, or is it more, you know, momentum driven and experimental?
It's a little of both. My editor likes to use outlines whenever he does anything. I know other people who just kind of jump right in and free write. And I do a little of that. I use what I call a draft line. It's a hybrid of an outline and a full-on draft. And that I sort of invent paragraphs and I restructure them as I go along. Each one has a topic, usually a thesis sentence or a subhead. And I just kind of write down my thoughts on each one. Sometimes I go through bullet points, and those have three or four sentences each. Other times I just kind of free write what's on my mind at the given moment. And then here's the key. I walk away from it. I do something completely different. I write a different article. I play a game of Sudoku. I do customer support for Grolix. And then an hour later, I come back, and I reread what I've put down. And I say, this works, that doesn't, this makes sense, I can shape this up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great technique because too bad we often don't have time for it, so we neglect this, but actually going back to your own writing is a very powerful thing. Is there any typical... Are there any typical mistakes that you suddenly face when you look at your writing once more?
Typical mistakes. I find that I have to question a lot of my assumptions about the topic, going back to how I don't have all the answers. Now, these days, I'm well aware of that, but even so, I can surprise myself with what I don't know.
That sounds great. I know one of the most important parts are definitely the title, the hook, the first couple paragraphs, and the closing words. Do you have any special techniques about all these parts?
Yes, I do. You're right that the intro and the conclusion are very important, and I try to wrap up the same way that I started. Sometimes I even copy the lead of the piece, and then I paste it down at the bottom, and then I rewrite it with different words. Because by the time that someone has finished reading or at least skimming the subjects in the piece, they should come back to the lead. They should come back with a better understanding, a different angle of what it all means.
Mm-hmm.
So basing the conclusion on the lead is really important. As for coming up with headlines, I always come up with at least a dozen headlines.
Whoa.
Yeah, put them at the top of the article in bullet points. And then I ask people their opinions about which one works, what doesn't. I find that I've got to write at least 8 or 9 before I start coming up with anything that's really creative and meaningful. So usually by the time I hit 11 or 12, it's pretty good.
That's a great technique, because most of us don't we undervalue the meaning of headline, and it means almost 80% of the success for the article. Is that true?
Do
you share the same opinion?
Oh yeah. The headline is something that is the hook's hook, you might say. It's the first contact that people have. It's the first thing they read, either in search results or whenever they're scanning a blog, for example. And if you don't have the right words in there, if you don't have the so what in there, then they're just going to pass you by. They're not going to read anything.
Do you have any personal approach, favorite approach to headlines? Do you like to keep them shorter, or do you like to make them, a few parts so that it contains a question and the answer all in its own, or do you mix and match?
It depends on what I'm writing. Mm-hmm. What I like to do a lot is, like I said, I come up with a so what factor, the what's in this for me question and answer approach. When you're writing a headline, you need to know what specifically is going to turn people on about it. What are they after? Because chances are they're not casual readers. They're looking for something.
Mm-hmm.
They're out there because they want to scratch an itch, as they say. They've got a problem. They're researching like I am. I don't get a whole lot of attention from casual readers. So you've got to be able to say in a very few words what they're going to get out of it. Not just what you're writing about, but what's in it for me.
Mm-hmm. And that thought gets extended into the first few paragraphs. So let me recap my own experience. What I try to fit into my first few paragraphs is to state who exactly it addresses, what pain it solves, and what the angle is definitely, and how we're going to address that. So the brief, concise overview, plus stating the importance of the article. What's your approach? What else do you try to fit in there? How do you hook up the readers?
I found that a two-paragraph approach works best for leads. The first one, like you said, states the pain or has some kind of a grabbing hook. For example, if we're talking about a podcast, this podcast, you might say that we're talking about UX. Well, that's interesting, but we're also talking about writing about UX. Okay, that's something. Well, we're addressing a pain point, perhaps. We're talking about, just making this up as I go along here.
Mm-hmm. Composing that's super interesting. Please do.
We're going to talk about, we've got this guy, he's a writer, and he's got a problem. He has to write everything every single day, and he's got to come up with a new approach to stuff that's been done before. That would be the first paragraph. The second paragraph actually tells people what they're going to get out of the article. And you see this a lot with professional writers. It's like the first paragraph is more of a story, but the second one is down to brass tacks. When I do research, sometimes I even skip the first graph if I can tell that it's not going to tell me what the post is about. You go right to the second one to get the summary.
Yeah, that's a great technique. I never thought about that this way, really. I think it's very important to be honest with the readers what exactly they will get out of this and what they should be expecting. And I think it's super important to state the audience too, who is that for and what it is about, iOS apps, web apps, anything else to give precise context.
Yes, if you're talking about something like iOS apps, then you're reaching for a specific audience. Now, naturally, given the audience for this podcast, for example, we're talking to designers or people interested in design. So you've already got that going for you. In my case, it's more specific. It's UX design, sometimes UI.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to know, what is this about? You kind of got me there. I've never had to actually speak it out loud. I have a sudden urge to write.
Feel free to think as much as you want.
When you're writing for an audience who's got some preconceptions about what you're writing, but they're looking for more information, you need to be able to either dispel their assumptions or to come up with an approach that makes them think they're going to learn something in about three sentences, two if you can manage it. Like you said, there's a particular audience, or you want to reach out to a particular audience, and you want to let them know, is this article for me? Because if it's not, they're going to move on anyway, and that's fine, because you're writing for a specific set of people. When you're writing, you never want to reach out to everyone. You can't. You can't please everyone. And what you're writing about can be so specific that you don't want to reach out to everyone. Instead, you need to let them know, this article is about X. This is going to talk about, say, iOS development. But not just iOS development. Here we're going to talk about icon design in UX and icon meaning in UX. And maybe even more granular, you can talk about whether you're going to use flat colors or line art. And that's going to help people figure out, is this for me?
Mm-hmm.
See, you can't know your audience. You don't know who's reading. You don't know really what they're after. They're just coming in, they're just reading your post. So it's up to them to figure out if they're the right audience or not.
That's true. Unless it's specifically, you know, founder's guide to something, it's sometimes more effective to address the audience by certain functions that they're looking for, subject functions, something that they're doing or interested in, right?
That's right. Oh, mm-hmm. Gosh, you've hit upon another quick subject there.
Great. I'm happy. That's awesome. So that's the writing process itself. I think we didn't touch on the editing part. Do you revisit your article one more time after you're done?
Yes, I revisit it. I reread it one more time, and then I reread it again, and then I reread it again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You find that 90% of the work is editing. If you can brainstorm, if you can just kind of dump all of your thoughts onto paper and then work on shaping it up, you're going to find that most of your work is trying to find the right shape and sweeping away the parts that don't make sense or that don't help the end reader.
Exactly. Do you have any tips for editing? Like, I'll share mine so that you have an example. So I'm all for simple as possible so that people don't have to sift through longer sentences. My friend Marion from Australia told me that her approach is to have one idea per sentence and not even more. So that like made my approach to simplicity even more straightforward. Also, dynamic sentence length, like make long sentences than short so that it's interesting and like kind of musical to read, and also eliminate all passive voices so that easier to grasp. I think that's my own editing points. Yours are probably more complex and professional. Please share them.
Well, I like those three that you got there. I have an allergy actually to passive voice. I do not hesitate to go back in and trim out the word be or to be or to do something.
Mm-hmm.
One idea per sentence, that is a great idea. And also altering the cadence of your sentences.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you want to ask questions in the post and then answer them immediately. I often trim those out, but I find that asking questions of yourself as you write is a really good way to figure out what the focus of each paragraph is.
So there are sentences like, but how do we do that? Like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they kind of sums up the previous one and sets up exactly that you said, what we're going to talk about. So do you cut them out essentially afterwards?
Quite often I do. They're mm-hmm. useful in figuring out what the article is going to look like. I guess sort of in a visual sense in my head, at least.
Mm-hmm.
But I trim them out quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Questions are useful to you. But it's not about you. It's never about the author.
True. So true. That should be written on the forehead of every author.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Or at least paste it on their monitor somewhere.
But, yeah, you can see what's on your forehead, right?
Really? A screen desktop picture, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Right. So anything else about editing?
Get a second point of view. Close yourself in a room and record yourself reading it aloud.
Oh, that's like double, triple work.
It is. But again, most of your work is in the editing part, going back and figuring out what works and what doesn't. With my stuff early on, I discovered that I could cut my articles in half. If I had a 1,000-word piece, it would get down to 500, and then I'd be in trouble. I have to go out and find a whole new set of ideas, because the sentence structure that I used was not very efficient. You want to squeeze as many ideas into it as you can. There's a concept called idea density in blog post writing, and you want to have a very high ratio of ideas to words.
And it's not about squeezing, it's about cutting out the noise, the water, whatever doesn't bring value, right?
That's very true. It's signal versus noise, to coin a phrase. And if you can do it without a word, that's very important, but you don't want to trim out too much. So it's a really tricky balance that just comes from experience. Once again, I found that reading things aloud, as silly as it sounds, to you, get yourself some recording software, or at least find yourself a quiet room and read it aloud and figure out what sounds right to you.
Actually, as we're recording this podcast, I'm super enjoying the information density that you have in your answers, because as compared to typical guest who doesn't have 8 years experience of teaching people and writing about stuff, your information density is like triple X a normal person, because we do water down our ideas with like duplicating words. We talk it over and over. And you're like super on point, and I'm enjoying it so much. In half an hour, we already got like covered three times what the normal person does. See, I'm repeating myself here and you don't. That's amazing.
being redundant again. That's okay. Yes. I find a lot of the time when I start writing stuff, I don't even use complete sentences sometimes. When I first do brain dumps, I just do the flow of consciousness. And it's only in the second pass when I get back to that draft line concept, the hybrid draft and outline. That's when things start to come together. And that's when I can go back and say, this is my lead, which is typically buried about five paragraphs down.
Right. I see so many people starting their articles, if they are not very familiar with writing sales copy or articles or whatsoever, they start leading with like some scientific terms and very complex ideas from paragraph one without stating all these important things. That's super common. Like, I wouldn't state it if I didn't see it like 25 times in my lifetime or something, you know? So it's helpful to remind yourself that there will be people reading about that. They need to know what's in it for them. Just write exactly as you said.
It's really hard to avoid jargon if you know the terms yourself, if you're familiar with the industry terms. I still find myself doing this, using terminology, using phrases that I assume the readers know. Quite often I can get away with it because my audience is so specialized that chances are, yes, they do know about iconography and typography, and they can at least tell a serif from a sans serif. But when you're teaching something, which is essentially what blog post writing is doing, if you're writing a tutorial or if you're on your soapbox and you're trying to make a point about something that really irks you, what you're really doing is you're trying to come up with the best way to get your point across. Let me think. How can you say this? And I say, here's where I'm going to start to go back and redo my draft. You've got to learn to question your assumptions about your audience. You can't insult them by spelling everything out, or else you've lost them. They don't see any value in your piece. At the same time, you can't get too much into the tech talk, into the terminology, unless your audience is really, really looking for something technical, then you just can't.
Because they're not rocket scientists, you know, surfing web. They're looking for solutions. They might be someone, not even a designer at all, looking for a quick fix. There you go with your jargon.
That's certainly possible.
Actually,
especially in the first couple of paragraphs, you never want to get too technical. You want to describe a problem in lay terms as best you can. And I think the best way to do that is simply to write and get feedback from people either in the industry or people who don't know what you're talking about at all. And you have to ask them. When you're getting feedback, you've got to ask them point blank, well, not just what do you think, That's a terrible question. You never want to ask someone, what do you think?
You're going to get, that's great.
Yeah, you always want to say, here's what I'm going for. I'm trying to explain this topic. This is my angle. Do you think that I've achieved that? Do you think that this article gets that point across? And where does it fall down?
So true. Any tips, any other tips for getting constructive feedback from your peers and from your editors? That's a whole different topic because I've been looking for guidance from editors for years, and that always boils down to like grammar improvements and stuff and minor ones too. So I've never been like truly successful in getting guidance from anyone. What are the questions to ask when you want this guidance from your friends or editors?
Well, it's funny. You got to kind of guide them to the guide, as it were.
Right. That's true.
You've got to start off by saying, this is rough. I'm looking for high-level feedback. I think that's a pretty good phrase, at least with the people I've worked with. If you say, I'm looking for a copy edit, you're going to get different feedback than if you're saying, I'm looking for an idea review.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're right. People will nitpick grammar, and you've just got to wash over that, come back to them and say, great. What about the ideas? Does that really gel? Does it make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just a disclaimer, that my previous sentence was not to blame my editors, who were great all through all of my years, but I just failed to communicate my needs probably myself, so that was a question about. So true. So going back to the editor part, do you have professional editors working with your drafts there at UXPIN?
Yes. In fact, I've got two editors. We're a team of about five people in the marketing team. Mm-hmm. That's technically what I fall under, although I do some customer support as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got two guys, Jerry Cow and Ryan Riddle. Mm-hmm. And Ryan's been a journalist for many years, and he's a good friend of mine who does a fantastic read. He understands the difference between a high-level and a low-level review, and he's very good at gently telling you that your article sucks.
how would he do that, like, typically?
Well, he that's a good question. I wish that I could do it. He'll come back with something. I'll send him a piece. I'll say, Ryan, I've got this. What do you think? Ooh, no, that's not good. I've got to say to him, Ryan, I'm going for this angle. Do you think I've hit the mark? And he'll come back and he'll just flat out tell me yes or no. And then he'll elaborate on that. It's usually not as binary as it sounds off in the beginning. But if you can come up with just a quick answer when you're giving feedback, it's like, have I achieved this goal? Yes, but you could use some shoring up here and there. Mm-hmm. Or you come back and you say, a good editor will say, nope, you haven't got it. You've missed the mark completely. Here's where it works.
Mm-hmm.
Because not all feedback is negative. Not all feedback is, well, you missed this part. That doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. You also want to find out what does work. What direction should you be going in? What succeeds, and elaborate on those parts as best you can.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, because I'm giving feedback and critique for a living, and definitely everything starts with highlighting what works and what's good, and from there on you can figure out what doesn't work, and that doesn't help unless you tell people what to do instead. So there always got to be a lot of content in your feedback, whether that's positive or not.
That's right. And when I work with new writers, I do try to get in as much positive feedback as I can. Tell them what works so they've got an idea of which direction to go after that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There is one more topic I'd love to touch upon because we are talking about specifically UI UX writing and design writing. I find it very hard to illustrate it well. You must probably have run into that problem as well. Do you have any specific tips for our audience?
With illustrations, start sketching as early as you can. When you're in your brainstorming session, you need to be thinking about the visuals. When you are editing, you need to go back and think about more visuals and what works and what doesn't. you always need to think about what it's going to look like on the page. Now, I know that blog posts, in theory, should be platform agnostic, but the fact is it's going to be put in a blog somewhere. It's going to appear on a web page, and you need to understand the context of the presentation, the design, if you will, of what's going on. So whenever I'm working on something, especially if it's aimed at designers, I know that I'm going to have to spell out, you have to spell out what is going on without words. I know that that kind of contradicts what I've been saying, but you've got to be able to show a chart or a diagram with as few words and labels as possible, and you've got to do it early on. Same thing for getting feedback. I sometimes send my draft lines to Jerry and Ryan, especially Jerry, who understands structure quite a bit, and just get their feedback and say, here's what I'm going for. Here's what I think it's going to look like. Here's how I want it to be received, and go from there.
Mm-hmm. I imagine there are several types of illustrations you can provide for your article. For example, that might be screenshots of other people's stuff. That might be intentionally produced diagrams and illustrations, or it can be fragments of your existing work. Do you have any specific recommendations about any of these types? What do you use most?
Well, once again, it depends on what you're trying to get across. Sometimes it can be a diagram of a screenshot, and you want to call things out. For example, in UX Pen, I had to do a lot of diagramming for where things are in the app, where things have moved to in the redesign. So what I did was I did took some screenshots, and at first I used just kind of text on the side outside of the window, and I used lines to point out things, but that wasn't very effective. It just added clutter. I wanted to reduce clutter. I always want to reduce as much as you can. So what I wound up doing was I set up in Photoshop, sometimes Pixelmator, a white screen, about 40-50% white, just a plain white layer on top of the screenshot. And then I cut out circular holes, what I want to call attention to. So there's a lot of variety in what you want to do. So I should point out that lately, in the last year or so, I've been experimenting with animated GIFs. I find that whenever I need to demonstrate something in an app in particular, a series of steps benefits a lot from a repeating, slowly made GIF or GIF. Which do you prefer?
Right. You have any specific tools for producing those?
Yeah. The secrets to my success is called GIF Brewery. It's a Mac app available in the App Store.
Great.
And you combine that with QuickTime, and you get some really high-quality animated GIFs.
Sounds amazing. Yeah. A little bit technical detail. So your blog at UX Pen, what width do you use or sizes do you use for the images? Any technical requirements that we can steal and use for our own blogs?
Well, when I go back and let me think, that's the blog width is 700 pixels. The blog teaser is an excruciating 720 by 200 pixels. We're not really concerned.
I hate those.
Yeah, that's really tricky to do, especially because the blog actually puts teaser images in two places, and one of them is 340, I think, by 200. So you've got to make sure that the center works. Right. And then the 700 wide, so I end up with a lot of extra space on the sides. That's real tricky to deal with.
It's like Product Hunt. They have requirements for their header, which is like something of the similar scale or proportion. It's really painful to pick images like that.
Yeah, what do you do with a shape like that? I've found a lot of ways to make things horizontal, a series of items or just a bunch of lines.
Oh, tangent topic. I think the worst I've seen is on YouTube channel cover images. If you ever face those, they require you something like a huge 16x9 2600 pixel something.
Gosh.
And of that, they cut out a small, like, horizontal stripe in the very middle of that. Like, where the hell do people get these images from? The only way you can do that. It's like abstract photo, which doesn't really matter where the things are, but you want to place something in an image, you know? Sorry, that's
know
really
exactly
big
what
pain.
You mean. Oh yeah, it's incredible. And the worst part is they don't tell you. I had to do mine by trial and error, a lot of that, trying to figure out, okay, here's the size they want, but this is what they really mean.
Right.
You know, for the life of me, I still don't know where they use the full picture.
It's on the TV. It's seriously on the TV, like on certain applications where they get the full screen preview for a profile.
But oh, my gosh.
Nowhere. That's not on any other device. I think they've made it probably more transparent with time, like where things get shown and which, but still, like the requirement's crazy.
Yeah, it's real tough. Something else we're not worried about yet, except in emails, is high-resolution displays.
Right.
I'm sure it's going to come back at some point, and we're going to start producing 1,400-pixel-wide graphics instead of 700. But we're not too worried about that on our blog yet. Our emails, yes, we are, but not in the blog.
I'm producing, I'm using 900 by 450 for our podcast guest portraits, and that's worked out pretty well. And then I'll just do, I don't know, I just do full-size screenshots for articles so that people can click on them and see for look for detail, because I feel it's unfair to limit screenshots to something small. I don't know. What's your take on this?
Yes,
with screenshots, I'm sorry, with screenshots, it's really tough to get a full screen if you're tearing down a web app, which is very often in my case. What do you do with the scale?
Well, I do two things. First, if I can get a large enough screenshot, then I will. You always want to start big because it's easier to go down than up. What I like to do, given my 700 pixel restraint for today, I'm sure that'll change at the last minute and I'll have to go back and redo stuff again. I like to shrink things down to about 600, 540 to 600 pixels. Let's say my screen is a typical 13-inch laptop computer. I'll take a screenshot as big as I can, make a copy, shrink it down to 540, 600 pixels, and then do a call out. You give both the context of the whole window, but then you give a focused area, just a quick crop of what you're talking about with a little zoom indicator. It's like, difficult to say this over a podcast, but if you circle or you block out, this is where it's coming from in the grand scheme of things. And then you have the pixel to pixel size of what you're talking about. People seem to understand that better than if you just do a simple screen grab and say, the bottom left-hand corner.
That's so true. Actually, 3 years ago, I wrote a book on that. That didn't go anywhere, but it was called Mastering App Presentation, where I was exactly like trying to accentuate that power of these different tricks, like call-outs and stuff, which you see so many masterful portfolio presentations on Behance, for example. You can definitely learn from them. When it comes to illustration, for example.
Yes, very much so. They do a great job of presenting stuff.
Even though sometimes that's not the best stuff UX-wise, it's still so pretty. Oh, my goodness.
and that's really their focus. You know, that's what they want. Because their audience isn't there looking for technical answers or necessarily the most useful stuff. They're there because they're looking for something that looks great.
That's
so they
true.
They do a good job of speaking to their audience.
Exactly. But when we're writing, we want to make sense with our stuff. So it's not our road.
That's very true. Something else you should look at.
I think the author bio, if you work with other authors, what would you recommend that they put in their bio? Because that's such a small yet powerful paragraph that we often neglect. Any recommendations there?
Let's see, in the author bio, you need to get to the point pretty quickly. You want to have your credentials, certainly, but you also want to have a little sense of yourself in there. In fact, I should probably revisit my bio. I like to do that about once a year and figure out not just what makes you such a great expert in something, but give a sense of who you are. It's important to have a little personality here and there throughout your work, and that certainly includes the bio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really bad at that, because stating credentials is easier, but it's tough to make your personality shine through at the very desired extent. Not too much, not too little.
That's definitely an instance where you need to go back and revisit it after, say, a day for about a week. Mm-hmm. You write something, you edit it a little bit, then you walk away. You come back to it with fresh eyes.
Right. So we touched on the main, you know, steps of the publication process. Did I forget anything super important?
Well, seek feedback as early as often, like we said, as early as possible. Don't make any assumptions, or at least try to identify your assumptions. Research the heck out of it so that you know what's been done before and what you can do that's different.
Mm-hmm.
Have a little personality. Write as many headlines as you can, say about a dozen. I know people who do more. And keep at it. Are you familiar with National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo?
No, not at all. What is that?
NaNoWriMo is an annual event, takes place in November, where the goal is to write a 50,000-word novel in 30 days.
I think I heard of that, right?
It's an incredible experience. It's a mad dash to the finish line. Lots have been written about writing in that and participating. I've done that for, I think I'm coming up on my sixth year.
So you've written six novels for that?
Well, six drafts.
Okay.
And one of them was a rewrite of a previous year.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the idea is you get in there and you just put down as many ideas as you can. Editing will come later. But it's a terrific way. It's a great exercise. It's a real rush to figure out where your strengths lie. It's just to get in there and do it every single day if you can.
So true. Sorry. Go.
I was going to say, if you're a designer and you think you can't write, well, chances are you're correct. You can't write
yet.
Keyword is yet. You just have to practice every day. And chances are you're already practicing. You just don't know it. You're writing notes to yourself. You're writing emails. That's composition. That's putting it together.
I found that, mastering the writing skill, at least to my, dilettante extent, have been the most critical advancement in my career that I ever made and that I will ever be able to make. Because it all boils out to writing, books that build authority, articles, consulting reports. You have to express your own, thoughts in your own voice eventually. So you'd better start early.
Yes, get out there and just start doing it. Make it a habit. If you can, spend half an hour at least getting your thoughts on paper. You can take the outline approach. You can just brainstorm and free write. But you just got to do it. And you find that even if you don't plan to be a writer, if you don't plan to publish, if you don't have a blog, that your understanding of your specialty will improve because you're trying to articulate what you're doing.
Absolutely. And one more tip, a little bit tangent. I always try, in the end of my articles, I try to look for common patterns and briefly recap them in an actionable section. Like, I found that to be a very good tip. I know that's not very relevant to the whole strategy things, but try to make it actionable and try to, recap your own writing so that it's short and applicable to real world. How does it sound?
That sounds very good, actually. The blog doesn't necessarily end with the last sentence. People mm-hmm. will go forth and hopefully they'll take away your ideas and apply them. Mm-hmm. Now, if you do that with bullet point tips at the end or if you weave it in throughout the article, either one works. It depends on your style or how you want to convey things. But yeah, hopefully people will take away something. They'll come back to your article if necessary. But if you've given them something to think about, then your blog hasn't really finished. It's still going on because a blog post, a tutorial, isn't just words on screen or in print. It's the idea behind this, it's the spirit. It's what you're trying to get across.
Absolutely. These words are gold. Thank you so much for sharing them.
Oh, you're welcome.
So wrapping up today's episode, where can people find you online?
Well, you can find me a couple of different places. You can find me at uxpen.com/studio. That's the main blog there. You can also find me at getgrolix.com/blog, or just getgrolix.com. I don't know. Do you have show notes for this?
Oh, absolutely. That's why I'm scribbling them down.
Oh, great. I'll make sure I get you the proper spelling of Grolix.
I definitely know. I know all the links. Don't worry.
That's great. Those are the two main places you can find my work.
Anything more personal than that?
Well, I do have a personal blog. I admit it's rather dusty. You can find me at benthinken.net.
That's what I was going at.
I try to keep the works that I want to be known for there.
Are you active on Twitter by any means?
Yeah, you can find me at three places. As a matter of fact, my personal handle is Ben Thinken. You can find me, my professional handle for UXPen is UX_Benjamin.
Great, Benjamin.
And for Grolix, it's Grolix Comics with two X's there.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is packed with super actionable advice. Thank you so much. I couldn't even expect that it's going to be so awesome, even more. I mean, I knew we are going to be onto something, but this is amazing. Thank you so much for sharing.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to articulate my thoughts.
That's great. Hope to see you again.
All right.